This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program today, we're going to hear a tale of an amazing river and an amazing descent of that river. Our guest is geophysicist and adventurer Pasquale Scaturro. In 2003, he began the first complete descent of the Nile. Scaturro joins us to talk about the people and the challenges he and his fellow explorer and cinematographer Gordon Brown met during their trip. They traveled more than 3,000 miles from the river's source in Ethiopia to the shores of Alexandria, where the river empties into the Mediterranean Sea. The expedition took 114 days. Pasquale Scaturro and Richard Bangs have written a book about the Scaturro-led descent of the river. The title, Mystery of the Nile, the epic story of the first descent of the world's deadliest river. Bangs is also an explorer. He's a writer, co-founder of an international adventure travel firm, and has produced documentaries and websites. Bangs had made his own attempts to descend the Nile, but he did not go with Scaturro and Brown. In the foreword to Mystery of the Nile, Bangs says he first pitched down its upper reaches, the Nile's upper reaches, in 1973. He named his adventure company Sobek after the ancient crocodile god worshipped along the river, thinking that might offer some protection. But he says he was wrong. He says, quoting here, "Over the years, many crocodiles attacked our boats, and the Blue Nile stole the life of my best friend and early partner, Lou Greenwald." Scaturro's and Bang's book, Mystery of the Nile, is published by Putnam, and in conjunction with the publication of the book, a new IMAX film by the same name is being released nationwide. It opened at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago earlier this month. Pasquale Scaturro, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure, my pleasure. You know, on the one hand, it seems hard to believe that no one had made a complete descent of the Nile. On the other hand, you know, learning about the dangers and the obstacles you faced, it seems incredible that anyone could do it. How many explorers had attempted a descent of the river in recent times?
You know, during the last 200 years, and let me just say, now, we've tried to get all the information we could. We've read all the books. You know, we've asked everybody we know about information on the Blue Nile. And so far as we know, during the last 200 years, there have been probably somewhere between 15 and 25 expeditions and groups of people that have gone down. You know, it started, one of the biggest expeditions to really attempt it was in the early 1900s, I think 1905, by an American. And he went ahead, and a guy named McMillan, he went ahead and took some boats over there and, you know, tried to do the river, and, of course, crashed his boats in the first mile, tore them up, and he bailed out. So we think it's somewhere around, you know, somewhere between 10 or 15 and 25, and out of that, we know of at least 15 to 20 deaths that happened.
Yeah. You know, I had no idea that the Nile was so dangerous.
Yeah, you know, no one does, really. It's really amazing. People, when they see the IMAX film, they're just blown away by how many rapids there are. You know, it really is. And it's not only just the rapids. You know, the upper part of the river, it starts at 10,000 feet. The spring starts at 10,000 feet in Ethiopia. And then it goes for the next, you know, 300, 400 miles through really big white water, you know, steep canyon and gorges and drop-offs and little waterfalls and big waterfalls. And then there's crocodiles, and there's hippos, and there's people shooting at you. You know, think guys called shiftas who are bandits. And there's militias. They took us into custody twice, going trying to go down the river. And there's, you know, the malaria and schistosomiasis, and there's just all kinds of little things that can happen to you.
Yeah. The first chapter is just a hair-raising account of what can happen in a rapid. You want to tell us that story?
Yeah, what happened was I was keenly aware how dangerous the river was. You know, Richard told me about it. His partner Lou died in the 70s trying to run this section of the river. And a fellow named Mike Speaks, a good friend of mine, a great river guide, almost drowned. In fact, he thought he was dead in 97, and he refused to go back. And so when we went through this part of the river, I was petrified of losing someone. And so we tried to ghost boat, or we tried to run a rapid with a boat empty. You know, sent the boat through with no people. And of course, we were going to film this in IMAX, and the boat flipped in the deepest part of the rapid in the gorge there. And then what we did is we went ahead and we jumped in the river to try to save the boat, and one of my guards with me, he ran in, tried to save the boat, and he almost drowned, and then I ran in and jumped in to try to save him. Next thing I know, we're both in the water, and the boat's upside down, and, you know, it was chaotic, and it was a serious mistake that I had made. We should never have tried to film with just the three of us this bad section of river, and I definitely should never have allowed any of us to jump in the water and go after the raft. But, you know, it was so early in the expedition that I was afraid if we'd lose our raft at that point in time, you know, the expedition would have failed completely.
Yeah. At what point in the expedition did that happen?
Oh, guy, day five. Yeah. You know, 114 days, it was like right in the beginning. And, you know, here we are, we've got a $500,000 IMAX camera, and I've got this huge expedition that, you know, we were pumping it up as being the last great first and, one of the great river expeditions of the world. And here we are 5 days into the expedition, we're about ready to lose all of our equipment. It was just terrible.
Yeah. Well, at the end of that first chapter, I'm thinking, this is nuts. And you know, later readers will learn about your encounters with the hippos and crocodiles and the arrests and being shot at and all that. You know, and, you know, right at the end of the first chapter, I'm thinking, what keeps you forging ahead?
I don't know. Good question. I've done a lot of rivers and mountains, and I guess, you know, like climbing Mount Everest and things like that. I helped take the blind guy, the bear climber, the blind climber top Mount Everest. I guess mountaineering and this stuff teaches you mental endurance, and it teaches you that no matter how terrible and cold and miserable and horrible everything gets, you know, you kind of say, okay, just keep going. And that's kind of what happened. You know, there's a few times where we were bummed. We were just so sad that we wouldn't make it, you know, like when we were in jail and we couldn't get across Lake Nasser. But, you know, we kept thinking, if we could just get through this next rapid, it'll be okay. Mm-hmm. And through this next canyon, it'll be okay. And, you know, before you know it, you know, you just don't think about tomorrow. You only think about today. Yeah. And, you know, before you know it, you know, you're 1,000 miles down the river and then another 1,000 miles down the river, and then you're at the Mediterranean,
I guess it's that old, you know, way of getting through really difficult moments, no matter what they are, no matter if you're on the Nile or, you know, you're in Champaign-Urbana. Sometimes you just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other.
I think a lot of people forget. We fail to realize that the sun's going to go down and it's going to come up in the morning. You know, no matter what happens, the sun's going to come up tomorrow. And it's like climbing a big mountain. You know, you put one foot in front of each other enough times, and you're going to get to the top. It's the same thing with the river. You know, when we were in the Northern Gorge, and there was rapid upon, you know, class 5, 6 whitewater, one rapid right after the other, and every one of the rapids is tough, and we got to carry equipment or run the rapids or whatever. And we keep thinking, God, how many more can there be? And then finally, you know, you come to the end of them, and you go, you know, well, you're thankful it's done. You're thankful you didn't lose equipment. But, you know, eventually they do end. And nothing goes on forever.
Yeah. This too will pass. There are glimpses, though, throughout this expedition, through all the challenges, there are moments of great generosity on the part of the people you met along the way. And there are moments of great natural beauty. And that also has to play a role in helping you put that one foot in front of the other.
Yeah, you know, people ask me what, you know, the best time of the expedition was. You know, what's the greatest time? You know, of rapids or all this stuff. And I tell people, you know, my favorite time of the expedition was the time I spent, especially in the Sudan, with the people along the shore. Some of the most incredibly beautiful, friendly, giving, interesting people I've ever met in my life. And those are the times, those are the things that I remember most. You know, talking religion and politics with the Sudanese, Muslims in Sudan, you know, people that I thought all wanted us dead, that, you know, they all wished us ill will, You know, all the things you hear on the news today, you know, hear about the big gap in between the United States and the Muslim world. And it's just not true on a small sense, you know, with normal people. And that was just wonderful. And then the scenery, you know, I love the mountains in Ethiopia. I think the rapids and the waterfalls and all that stuff were just tremendous. I mean, world-class sights. But it was just the wide-open vistas of the Sahara Desert in Sudan with, you know, sand dunes hundreds of feet tall and, you know, date palms and rocks on the river. And it was just magnificent, magnificent sunsets, you know, skies full of stars all night. And it's something I'll never forget. It was just a wonderful experience.
What were you thinking, though, as you entered Sudan? Because, you know, here you're entering a country that's been at civil war for years.
Yeah, we were petrified. You know, needless to say, there was no time during the entire expedition where we were as petrified as entering the Sudan. You know, it was like a foreboding feeling we had. You know, here we are approaching the border. We didn't have permits. We had no permits to enter the country because we couldn't get them. No one ever goes down the river. It's in the middle, literally in the middle of nowhere. And we're coming to the border, and all we'd heard about was how dangerous it was. We were actually entering Blue Nile Province, which was one of the three hot contested areas in the Civil War with the SPLA. And here we're running through that without a permit. We were keenly aware of the problems in Darfur that was blowing up at the time. And so we were just petrified, just horrified trying to enter the Sudan. And every step of the way, as soon as we entered, it was like it was scary. And then as soon as we met the first series of army troops, you know, we met the Sudanese army, we immediately stopped off. You know, went over there and told them, here we are, we had no permits, we had, you know, $500,000 IMAX camera with us, and by the way, you know, no visas. And they introduced us to their general, General Mohammed, who came down to the river, and we almost immediately became friends. And almost instantly, things turned around. He was super friendly, and he actually hand-wrote us a small letter on a piece of scrap paper in Arabic. That letter got us all the way through Sudan with virtually no problems. And it was just an amazing experience.
Mm. What did that letter say?
You know, it said basically, it introduced Gordon and myself, it introduced Gordon and me as Americans coming through on a goodwill project to make a film about Sudan. And it was really nice. And everybody we showed it to read it and go, "Welcome to Sudan. Anything you need, we'll help you with. We're here to help you." And it was just like, you know, give me a break. I can't believe how easy this is, you know, in the Sudan. At least that part of the trip in the Sudan was unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about the film, the IMAX film. And as I understand it, that's really how this whole expedition, that's what sparked the expedition, correct?
It is. I've always wanted to do. I've done a lot of rivers in Africa, the Omo, Takaze, different rivers in Ethiopia and Africa, and I've always wanted to do the Blue Nile. And when Richard Bangs wrote a book on our first descent of the Takaze in '96, which is a major river in Ethiopia, and it was read. The people at McGillivray Freeman Films in Laguna Beach, the makers of the IMAX films. They read his book, and I was in the book, and they contacted him about information because they wanted to make a film of the Nile. And immediately, you know, they had no idea how to make this film, really. And so they called him, and immediately he said, you know, we need to do a river trip. He says, that's how you're going to tie this whole Nile topic together. And they said, well, that's a great idea, but we don't know anybody, and he recommended me. And then I met with them, and we got together, and I told them, I said, it's a great idea to do a river trip, but there's only one way in which I would want to do the river, is I'd want to go ahead and run it source to sea, because if we can do a first full descent of the Nile and document it with an IMAX camera, the same camera that went up Mount Everest, by the way, then I think you could have a world-class adventure, and you can make a great film that has a lot of meaning to it other than just, you know, pretty helicopter shots. And so then that's how the whole thing with the IMAX started.
Yeah. You know, making a movie in this kind of terrain has got to be, to put it mildly, rough. And there are moments where apparently you have to, it's like, well, we got to take that again.
Yeah.
How do you face that? I mean,
it is really hard. The IMAX camera weighs 100 pounds. During the most of the expedition, once we left Ethiopia in the Northern Gorge, it was just Gordon and myself, and then occasionally Michelle, a photographer. You know, the IMAX camera weighs 100 pounds. It takes all day to load and shoot a 3-minute shot, because it's $4,000 it costs for 3 minutes worth of film in the IMAX camera. You don't have a lot of choice. And so what we would do is we would go into these areas and we would hike along the river, and if there was something we really liked, we'd come back and we'd set the shot up, and then we'd try to get the shot. And it's really difficult with two rafts, a kayak, and basically only two boatmen running the whole thing. And so we talk about how challenging the river is, but the actual shooting the river with the IMAX camera, you know, the fact we had an IMAX camera along made it, you know, 10 times as difficult.
Yeah, how does this expedition compare to, you know, all the other things that you've done, whether it's doing Everest or going down the other challenging rivers of the world?
This was by far and away the hardest. I had to pay more attention to detail on this. You know, I had to be super disciplined at all times. You know, whether it's taking journal entries or doing my maps or filming. It's so remote, and there's so many objective dangers in it that, you know, that we had to be constantly on guard. And I would say it's by far, I'd say it's much more difficult, at least mentally, this, than Everest was for me. It was just more going on every day. You know, I'd say it was really tough.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, geophysicist and adventurer Pasquale Scaturo. In 2003, he began the first complete descent of the Nile. The expedition took 114 days. Our guest, Pasquale Scaturo, and Richard Bangs have written a book about the descent of the river, the title Mystery of the Nile, the epic story of the first descent of the world's deadliest river. Sparking the expedition and what led to the book was an IMAX movie by the same name, Mystery of the Nile. In conjunction with the publication of the book, the film by the same name is being released nationwide. It opened at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago earlier this month. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have two questions. I have also a personal comment. I used to be in a canoe, and I never did anything as exciting as your guest. But I talked to somebody who climbed Mount Everest, and I said, what is the joy in this? And he said, in retrospect, I want to hear his opinion. I have not read the book, but is it in retrospect? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer off the air.
Okay, good question. At the end of the day, where is the joy?
You know, I guess there's a lot of joy in just seeing things that you know, virtually no one else has seen, especially along the Nile. There's also the joy of knowing you're the first. I think there's a little bit of ego involved in that, you know, just saying, hey, you know, I got a first. And that's not the reason we did it. You know, the subject boils down to what drives us, and I think it's just that inner sense of adventure, the desire to go where you don't think you could go and to challenge yourself both physically and mentally. And I remember when I got to the top of Everest, it was just an unbelievable feeling. You know, I was 10 feet from the summit, and I thought, you know, I just can't. You're just shocked that you had the capability, the physical and mental capability to do that. The Nile was the same way. Unlike Everest, we were able to explore and experience so much more on the Nile than I'd ever imagined. And that's what keeps driving you back. It's that sense of discovery and that almost childish feeling of discovering things for the first time, you know, knowing no one else has seen them. That's kind of what draws you. You know, it's a sense of adventure, and I think you're born. They say you're kind of born with it. They say there's kind of, you know, they're thinking maybe there's a gene or something. I guess maybe that's it. But if that's the way it is, I got a lot of those genes because I really love doing it.
Yeah. When were you first aware of this drive within you to conquer the seemingly unconquerable?
You know, when I was a little kid, two things happened. When I was a little kid, I think it was in third grade or second or third grade. I was in inner city L.A. in Hollywood, California, and one of the teachers took me up in the public school teacher, paid my way to go to boys' club camp up in the mountains. And I went there, and I climbed San Gorgonio Mountain, tallest mountain in Southern California, and I was a little kid. And everybody dropped out of the whole climb except me and one of the counselors. And I was crying and crying, and finally we made it to the top. And as soon as I got to the top of the mountain, I immediately forgot that I was tired, and it was the greatest thing of my life. And then when I was my family moved out of Hollywood in Southern California, and I would stay. I would get my bicycle and I'd ride away when I was a little kid. I'd throw my mom nuts, and I would just camp out for like 2 or 3 days at a time all by myself. And I just loved being out in the middle of nowhere, kind of like just exploring things, nobody knowing where I'm at. And I just have, I guess I've kind of kept that. I always look forward to just going out and just kind of disappearing into these places. And it's in your blood, you know.
Yeah, I don't have that gene. Although when I was a kid, I loved climbing trees, and there was a wonderful tree, you know, a couple blocks from us in an area that had not yet been developed. We called it the climbing tree, and it was just fabulous to get up, you know, from a relatively high up in the world, and take a look around.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was the same way as a little kid. I had tree forts I'd build. You know, really complicated tree forts with the trap doors and all that. It was the same. It's the same way. It's amazing. And you know, and I keep thinking halfway through these trips, I keep thinking, dang, this is such a drag. This is so hard. Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to do this again. And then, like the second you're done, you know, and you're flying back home or something, you start making all these plans for the next expedition. So, you know, what else is there to do?
What's next? What are we going to do tomorrow? The sun's coming up tomorrow.
Exactly. That's right. Sun's coming up tomorrow. I got to get something planned tonight.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello there. Go ahead.
Yes. In your intro, Celeste, you talked about crocodile gods on the Nile.
Oh, yes. Sobek.
Yes. Okay. Now, I'm interested in African art, and I know that the Dogon people, they're in Mali, have a crocodile god, which every time you go to any museum with African art, you will see that crocodile god, sort of abstract form of it. Does your guest know anything about that? I don't know anything myself.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Sobek. We floated right by the Sobek Temple, the crocodile god Sobek Temple on the Nile. So I'm really familiar with the Egyptian culture, but not the Mali, not the Dogon culture. Although virtually every culture in Africa, when there's a river, have the crocodile as either a god or, you know, as some sort of deity or something. It's just such a powerful figure, the crocodile. You know,
something to be frightened by.
It is. And not only there, I just got back from New Guinea. I was on the Sepik River in New Guinea, and that whole Sepik River area of just fascinating places, they have the same exact thing. The crocodile plays a huge part in their culture. And, you know, when you float down a river and there's huge, you know, 12, 13, 14-foot crocodiles, a lot of them, very aggressive, you pay attention to them. And I can see how people use the croc as a god.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Have you given some thought to why it is that we people will take something that can be so frightening and that it is so powerful and raise it to the level of deity?
That's a good question. I don't know. I was always, because a crocodile is just a scary animal. They're a predator. They're, one of the oldest predators around, and they're very aggressive. And I don't know. It's always baffled me. I respect crocs. It's about the only thing in Africa, one bit of wildlife in Africa that really scares me, because they're unpredictable. And I don't know, but they do. Virtually everyone does it. Even the Ethiopians, they're really big on crocodiles. So that's a good question. Maybe someone can help us with it.
That's a question for an anthropologist, I guess.
It is. And being at the university there, maybe someone there listening knows why it is.
Maybe that might be a good topic for another show down the line. And also another animal that is quite powerful, the hippo, and of course many of us are familiar with that beautiful blue hippo statue. Tell us about your encounters with hippos.
Hippos are although we talk a lot about the crocodile, big teeth and things, the hippos actually are more dangerous than the crocodiles to a lot of people. And the reason is they're mammals and they're territorial, and besides that, just being huge. And in the river, they live in the rivers. They graze up on the ground out of the river, but they stay in the water. And they being mammals, very territorial mammals. When you're in a raft, they're way scarier because one is they're huge. Their tusks, they can bite through a raft easily, and they can flip a raft if they came up under it. Also, too, if there's a female hippo, and there are babies around, if she has a baby there, they will attack an intruder or a raft instantly. They're very aggressive, and that's what's so scary. The croc will come up. We can usually, maybe heave a rock at it or slap a paddle or chase it off, but the hippos won't. Generally, the hippo, if it comes toward you, is not going to be not be deterred. And so we were much more scared of hippos. We did have one big, bad hippo charge where the hippo, we didn't even see it. It came up just about under the boat, came up all the way out of the water, went down and made a lunge at us, and we just barely got away with it, away from it. And so we were always really careful of hippos.
Yeah. Are there cultures, people who live along the river who think of hippos as godlike?
There aren't, amazingly enough. Huh. It's called Gumare is the word for hippo in Amharic and Ethiopian. But it doesn't carry nearly the same connotation as a crocodile. For example, there's no hippo god in Egyptian culture, although there had to have been hippos down there because virtually every river in Africa, if it's a perennial river, has hippos in it.
Yeah. I want to go back to the question of the first caller this afternoon and talk, investigate once again or examine a further examination of the issue of joy. And I want to ask you to tell the story about the first official day of your expedition. You're in Ethiopia. You set up camp for the night. And two young girls keep the fire burning for you at night.
Ah, you caught that when you read it. I wanted to even talk more about this than what we even put in the book. We're in Ethiopia, and we had gone all the way to the source. It was a long, long way up there. We got there almost at dark, and, we set up a camp, and we didn't have any firewood. And so all of a sudden the farmers come out of the Ethiopians are just wonderful people. Some farmers came out of the fields, and they brought over, they saw us there, and they chatted, and they all went back, and they brought a little bit of firewood, some twigs and some old brush and stuff like that, and built us a fire. And a few minutes later, just when it's dark, pitch black, a bunch of kids and families showed up. And so we had maybe 15, 20 people there. And they stayed awake all night. We were chatting. Everybody's around the fire, and they're talking. They brought us some food and stuff. And then as it got later in the night, everybody left. And I went to sleep. I was really tired. And I woke up. And that night, there were two little girls, 6, 7 years old, maybe 8 years old at the oldest. And they were sitting awake, laying at the fire, sitting awake, keeping the fire burning. And they'd stayed there all night, these two little girls, keeping our fire going and keeping the fire burning to keep us all warm. And there was no parent. There was no one else with them. And it was just the most amazing thing. Here are strangers, complete strangers, coming from out of nowhere into their little village, and the adults had their little tiny girls stay up and keep the fires burning for us so we wouldn't get cold. And it was just the most incredible experience, and it dawned on me how unafraid those people are of other humans. And especially today, you know, it seems like, at least in my opinion, it seems like we seem to be most afraid of our shadows anymore. We're afraid of, you know, terrorists, and we're afraid of meeting people we don't know, and we're afraid of our children walking home from school alone and things. That to see that type of innocence and to see that type of complete trust was a wonderful experience. Yeah. And that's something I'll never forget. That sight of those two little girls there all night keeping the fire burning for us is just amazing.
I'm glad I asked you about that, because that was a moment in the story that I just had to stop and think about that. You know, as you wrote in your journal, can you imagine leaving two of your young daughters to stay with strangers to keep a fire burning?
Yeah, it's amazing. But that's the type we saw along a lot of the people. You know, it's amazing. These people don't know about the war on terror. These people don't know about all these problems. They don't know, you know, they may know something about what happened on 9/11. But it just doesn't affect them. And I tell you, it's just that type of trust and innocence and that type of attitude we saw virtually all the way down the river with the vast majority of the people that we encountered.
Mm. You mentioned, you said you used the word chatting. Everyone is chatting before you turn in for the night. Are there communication difficulties? I mean, do you have someone along who speaks the language all the way?
Well, we did. I've been in Ethiopia and Eastern Africa for quite a few years. I did a bunch of geophysical projects in the Ogaden Desert in Ethiopia, Somalia in the early 90s. And I learned to speak pretty good Amharic, which is the main language that's used in Ethiopia. And I'm not completely fluent in it, but I'm functional in it. And I can actually talk to people and chat with them. And then we had an interpreter with us, and some of our helpers spoke some English. And so through them, we were able to communicate pretty well with everybody, although, you know, it's not as easy as if it was speaking English. So every time we went through a village, and also we were making a movie and I was writing a book and things, and so we went to the villages, I made sure to talk everybody up and ask a lot of questions and, you know, really get to know people.
Yeah. Yeah. How does the Nile affect the people who live along its banks? How does it affect the way they make a living? How does it affect their relationships with one another?
The Nile, especially in Egypt and the Sudan, is the reason for the existence of the people, period. I mean, without the Nile in Egypt and Sudan, and to maybe a little bit lesser degree Ethiopia, without the Nile, there would be no Sudan or Egypt. There would be no great cultures, no pyramids, no pharaohs. There would be no Cleopatra. There'd be none of that. It would just be dust, sand, and rock. And these people, the Nile is the great river. They call it the ocean. They don't even, the term in Arabic is ocean, is what they use for it. And it's just it's completely part of their lives. They live on it. That's where they get all the water, their sustenance. It's everything. It's just an amazing part of people's lives. And, you know, they got stories and they talk about it. And it's weird because we'd be there and they'd want to get a drink, like our helpers would get a drink, and they would just dip a cup in the water, and like they'd almost reverentially they drink this stuff. And so I'll tell you, if I had to pick a river to do it in, I couldn't have done better than the Nile.
Mm-hmm.
For that. Yeah.
But near the end, we see in Egypt, as you get into metropolitan Egypt, you see the huge human footprint on the Nile. It's a different story.
Completely. I really try to make, and I think we just hint on it in the movie, the difference between the Nile in Egypt or Ethiopia, and especially between Sudan and Egypt. In Sudan, it's a big, beautiful, wide-flowing desert river, clean, with sand dunes. Once it hits Egypt, it goes into the Aswan High Dam in the Lake Nasser. And from that point on, without being mean, it's basically just an irrigation ditch. It's channelized, it's increasingly so. It's heavily used. It's polluted. Trash is thrown in it. The sewage is dumped in it. It's drained. It's choked because of the dam and the fact that it no longer floods. It's choked with water hyacinth, and it's just a shock what happens to the Nile. And you know, the Egyptians still they revere the Nile. But they know, but they just don't take that good a care of it. And the thing is, they know it. You know, they talk to them, and they're torn with the fact that it's happening, but they just it doesn't seem like they're capable of taking action with it.
Mm. Of all the people you met along the way, was there any one individual who stands out in your mind as most unforgettable?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Let me think about
that. That's why
that.
That's why I qualified most unforgettable.
Oh, man. That's a really good question. You know, I think one of the guys that I probably... Wow, that's a good question. I think one of the guys I probably remember the most was probably Commander Muhammad, the very first guy we hit in Sudan. You know, we were afraid to death to come across the border. You know, we thought we'd just get shot, lined up and shot, and our stuff taken. And when I met this commander, he came trouncing down, you know, from the base, and he immediately shook my hand, and I immediately took a liking to him. We started talking, and he kept assuring me. He said, you know, I want to welcome you. You don't realize how much I welcome you to Sudan. He kept saying that over and over again. And I remember that because I went from unbelievable fear and loathing, to coin a statement, about what was going to happen, to just, I was happy. And I remember him, and I didn't want to leave, but we had to go. And I remember talking to him, and I think he's probably the guy I remember most, was that general, that Sudanese army general, the first guy we met in the Sudan.
Hmm.
So, hmm. It was an amazing experience. From being just petrified to, you know, happy.
Yeah. There were also moments of great tension between you and Gordon Brown. Mm-hmm. And the tensions, the conflicts, they could have scuttled the expedition. Would you want to talk with us a little bit about that relationship between the two of you and how you kept going?
Yeah, Gordon, this was really difficult for me to put in the book a lot. And we don't really touch on it in the film very much just because it's a long, detailed thing. But Gordon and I had a lot of problems. We were the last two left on the expedition after everyone basically bailed out on us. You know, we tend to be both fairly strong-willed, as you read in the book. And there was almost constant conflict. A lot of times I thought, I'd rather do this trip alone by myself than have Gordon with me any longer. You know, we were able to, that thing worked out. Towards the end of the expedition when I caught malaria, I had the worst bout of malaria. You know, Gordon all of a sudden seemed, you know, we kind of opened up, and it dawned on us that, hey, you know, he kind of took over and helped me and kind of took care of me while I recovered, and he kind of took over control of the running expedition. And from that point on, things seemed to change because it dawned on me that, you know, the majority of the problems we had was probably because we were so much alike. Both strong-willed, and our backgrounds are scary the same, too. You know, we both had mothers that there was a lot of mental illness in the families. Both our mothers were mentally ill growing up. We had to deal with that as children, so we learned to be independent as really young kids. And I think that colored us. And, you know, it was hard for me to put a lot of that in the book. And Gordon, Gordon took offense at a lot of that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
When he read the book, he, you know, he was shocked. But I told him, I said, that's what really happened. I mean, we may not remember it. And he accepts it now, and we're the best of friends. We really are. He still, you know, takes a little umbrage at some of the things I said. But... You know, it was tough, and it just about scuttled the expedition a bunch of times, especially when we were in Khartoum in the Sudan. I was just ready to say, hey, dude, you take your boat, you go on the trip, you go by yourself, and I'll go by myself.
Mm.
We were that close.
Yeah.
So, But we made it, and it's a testament to, I think, the will. You know, Gordon's both, you know, he's strong-willed and he's tough, and, you know, I'm happy to, now in retrospect, I'm happy to have had him as a partner.
Yeah. Do you think you two will ever join forces again for another expedition?
You know, we're talking about it, believe it or not. After reading that book, you think we'd shoot each other first time we'd see each other. But we're actually talking about it. We're, you know, we want to do the, like, the Mekong. That's never, it's guys have kayaked it, but they've never really done a big expedition on it. And we want to go back and try to do the upper section of the White Nile, too. And so we're actually talking about things. It's amazing how time heals all wounds, huh?
So what is next? Do you have something? Are you planning another adventure?
Yeah. I want to continue climbing big mountains. I want to go to K2 sometime in the next couple of years before I get too much older and my knees wear out. And I want to try that. And I want to. I'm also going to try to start climbing more of the big mountains in all the different countries. I'm going to travel from Africa, from Cape Town, South Africa, all the way to London in the next year and a half. I have a Land Rover. I prepared for that. And then I also want to climb all the top mountains in Africa. Go through every country of Africa, explore them, and then climb all the high points. That's kind of what's immediately on the agenda.
Wow. That's quite an agenda.
Yeah.
How do you prepare to attempt a challenge? How do you prepare to attempt a journey, both in terms of what you have to put together as far as the technology goes, and then what you have to do to make sure that you're in top physical shape and that you're mentally ready to do it?
One, you got to stay in shape. You know, I'm now 51, and I'll tell you, as you get 40s and 50, it is really hard to stay in shape. And so I'm constantly being careful what I eat. Try not to eat too much, and so I'm constantly kind of work out. And in terms of the logistics, the mechanical stuff, the technology stuff, again, that's hard too. I'm a geophysicist. I don't do these expeditions full time. I'm not a paid guide, and so I stay in the geophysical world and I stay up on technology, and all that added with my experience in logistics, being a geophysicist and doing things, you know, I've over the years gotten a lot of, you know, computer lists and ideas, and it's just a learning thing. And so if someone says, if you said, hey, let's go, you know, do a trip down the Amazon, you know, it'd take me a few minutes to, you know, find some information and put some trips together, and then you and I could go. So it's every day. Every day I have to try to stay in shape and keep on top of it.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time, I'm afraid to say. Pasquale, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Well, thank you.
Pasquale Scaturo has been my guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. In 2003, he began the first complete descent of the Nile. He and Richard Bangs have written a book about the descent of the river, the title Mystery of the Nile, the epic story of the first descent of the world's deadliest river. The book, Mystery of the Nile, is published by Putnam, and in conjunction with the publication of the book, a new IMAX film by the same name is being released nationwide, and it opened at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago earlier this month. And that month was February of 2005. Our interview with Pasquale Scaturo was conducted on February 23rd of 2005.